What is the most important e-discovery issue today?
Cost control?
Technology-assisted review?
Information management?
Preservation?
From the latest cases to the newest technologies.
Our goal is to expose legal professionals to the most important e-discovery trends
with the brightest e-discovery experts.
Rulemaking,
predictive coding,
litigation hold,
proportionality,
document review,
social media,
efficiency,
ethics,
cooperation. Welcome to the ESI Report, sponsored by Kroll On Track, an e-discovery software and service provider. You are listening to the Legal Talk Network.
Hi, I'm Michelle Lang, and welcome to the ESI Report. Brace yourselves, listeners. Today we are talking about math and statistics, two topics that make many legal professionals, including myself, somewhat uneasy. But as advanced technologies such as predictive coding play an increased role in e-discovery, familiarity with key statistical concepts is absolutely necessary to implement a defensible process and ensure an e-discovery success. But don't worry, you don't need to dust off your graphing calculator or go digging for your slide rule to make sense of these concepts. To help us understand what legal professionals need to know about math and stats in the age of technology-assisted review, I welcome Eric Robinson, Solution Architect at Kroll On Track. Hi, Eric. Thanks for joining me today.
Hi, Michelle. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Eric, let's get started. Can you give us a brief overview of why math and stats are playing a larger role in e-discovery today?
Well, as complicated as it sounds, it's really very basic. As technology has improved and allowed us to conduct more effective and efficient document reviews, it's become necessary to be able to validate that work in a very, in a not only defensible manner, but in a very qualitative and quantitative manner. So along those lines, whether it involves generating random samples or evaluating the metrics of a review, math and statistics have become a critical component of that process. The good news for most of us is that since most of us are not mathematicians or statisticians, there are tools available that will do those calculations for us and assist us through that process.
So what are some of the key metrics that legal professionals involved in a technology-assisted review or a predictive coding review in e-discovery, what are some of the metrics that they need to know?
So there are a few key metrics that legal professionals involved in e-discovery should be familiar with. And before I jump into that, let's make it clear that lawyers don't have to be the experts in all of these things. So there's experts out there, whether you've got them internal to your organization or it's an external consultant or whatever it may be. The critical path here is to understand the terminology and the concepts and what's there. Each lawyer does not have to become a statistician or mathematician through this process. But with respect to those key metrics, the first one is confidence level. Confidence level is, how likely is it that, a representative sample is going to represent the overall larger database? So generally, confidence levels are set around 95%. It can vary from matter to matter, strategy to strategy. Margin of error is another key metric. This is the plus or minus that goes along with that confidence level. So it can be 1%, it could be 5%, but it's looking at that margin because, let's face it, perfection is an aspiration. It's not something we actually ever achieve. So having that margin of error is important. And then with respect to actual technology assisted review, there are some key metrics that keep being thrown out there and we see them day in and day out. It's things like recall. Recall is the measure of completeness. It's a fraction of the retrieved documents within the total relevant documents that were found. Precision is a measure of exactness, and that's a fraction of the relevant documents within the actual retrieved results. And then you have F-measure. F-measure is, to use the technical term, is a harmonic mean or the average of recall and precision. So there's a calculations that go with all of these. We won't worry about that for the time, for the purposes of today. But those are critical. And then you have accuracy. Accuracy is how well your classifier or your algorithm is performing overall as you're training. And then error rate. Error rate is, to put it into simple terms, is 100% minus the accuracy rate, which gives you that small, hopefully, small rate for which there you could have error. So it becomes that buffer, for completeness. And then understanding these metrics is important to understand how well and how complete your process is. Absent these metrics, you have no way to validate your processes. And additionally, understanding these metrics allows you to make strategic decisions regarding your review. For example, can you stop your review? Are you comfortable stopping your review?
So let me see if I can repeat this back to you to see if I'm understanding it, to see if our listeners may understand it a little better. What you're saying is that these metrics, these mathematical descriptions that you just talked about, are the things that the keys that the document review administrator is monitoring, and that the administrator of the doc review is watching these things closely, and they come to this person in a series of reports, I would imagine.
Well, absolutely. And every I can speak to, how that's done, from the Kroll on Track perspective. And in many of the tools it's true. But there's reporting mechanisms that should be available to you to help monitor these things. Ideally, you're getting real-time reports where you're actually able to monitor these metrics in real time as your documents are being trained and as your review is progressing. The key is to be able to, so this is where the key is that you don't have to be a statistician, because if your tools are working for you, then their tools are providing you the information and the calculations are already done for you. It's understanding what those metrics are and how to interpret them.
Sure. And then interpreting them, these metrics to make decisions. So the humans and the legal analysis is coming into play because they are making decisions about how the machine is performing with regards to the review. Is the machine smart enough in categorizing documents for responsiveness? Is that sort of the gist of it?
Yeah, I think that's the gist. And I would go beyond, these metrics can also be used beyond the machine's learning. You can apply these same metrics to your actual review so that you can see how well your review is progressing. In today's world, the review is usually a mix of the technology-assisted portion as well as some level of human review. So you're able to look at your metrics both in a micro perspective as well as a macro perspective.
So maybe this is a good point to talk a little bit about a hypothetical example. Maybe you could walk our listeners through a case in which you were involved or one of your clients was involved at a high level, and talk about how these effectiveness metrics that you were just talking about panned out in the review project and helped the review team go one direction or the other?
Sure. So you can look at this in any number of ways. But one example is we had a client who had about 500,000 documents that they wanted to get through very quickly. And using statistical sampling, they pulled out 3,900 documents to train on. Following their training, they looked at their metrics and they weren't happy with where the metrics were. They had, for example, they had a precision rate of about 48%, which in all honesty is low. They had a recall rate around 60%, which isn't terrible, but could be brought up. And the way you do that is by understanding what these metrics are, is that you then can focus on where you may need to or want to retrain or train additional documents in order to teach the system so that these metrics, like precision and like recall, are increased and improved. So when they started, they had only trained on about 297 documents that had been coded as relevant. And of those, about 118 were not even suggested as relevant. So that really impacted their statistics. So what they were able to do was to go back in and look at things like, and there's throwing some more terms out there, is look at the false positives. So documents that had been identified as relevant but actually weren't, and false negatives, documents that were not identified as relevant but actually were. By looking at those numbers, and then going in and finding more documents to train on, they were able to really improve the metrics that they that they were getting. So that they went from, if you recall, I told you they went from a recall of about 40%. They went to a recall of just over 90%. I'm sorry, they had a recall of 60%. They went to 90%. And they went from a precision rate of 40% to over 50%. Now, they weren't done, but that small amount of effort allowed them in a very short period of time to really improve their metrics and statistics and improve the learning of the machine at the same time.
So, Eric, it sounds like the goal of leveraging technology-assisted review and being able to understand these metrics to properly leverage technology-assisted review is really to improve the efficiency of the review, maximize the role that the humans play, and be able to leverage innovative technology. Talk a little bit about some of the efficiencies that your clients are able to see.
Oh, absolutely. And I go beyond just the efficiencies. I mean, and we can get into more on that, but I'll answer your question directly first, is, you know, when we talk about the efficiencies, using the available technology, clients are able to, generally speaking, they're significantly reducing the amount of time it takes to get through the review, which for anyone who's had to write a check or had to give an invoice to a client for document review, knows that it's the single largest piece of the discovery process. There's all kinds of reports out there that says, you know, that says document review takes about 73 cents out of every dollar spent in discovery. So, you know, it's a huge piece, and anything that can be done to make that process more efficient is hugely beneficial. So not only does it actually reduce the time of the review, but it also, in many cases, allows clients to use smaller review teams because they're being able to leverage the technology to more definitively hone in on those documents so that they don't need as many individuals to necessarily go hunting and pecking through documents in a random way.
What are some of the biggest obstacles that you think are preventing this from wide, broad-scale adoption?
Fear, I think, is the biggest thing. I mean, human nature is to fear the unknown, and this is new. And I think it's safe to say that lawyers don't like change, generally speaking, and that's not that. I think it's just part of the reality of our industry of who we are. And this is something that's new, and it is a game changer. So I think that we're seeing it happen now, as this becomes more mainstream, as the whole technology assisted review becomes part of everyday litigation, that fear is subsiding. When I think beyond fear, and I say that kind of tongue in cheek, is that in reality, the biggest early obstacle was waiting for judicial acceptance. And that was, we had clients saying, well, when the courts say it's okay, we'll consider it. And when we had the court saying, well, someone bring us a case. So it was a chicken and the egg type of conversation. Well, I think we've gotten past that. There have been a number of decisions over the course of the last year to 18 months that have really brought technology-assisted review to the forefront. And the courts are saying, as many of the judges who go on these speaking circuits have said on their own, but now there's actually opinions out there that are saying, you know what, this is okay. And it's actually, not only is it okay, but it's probably a better way to go because it is more cost-effective, it's more efficient, it's more accurate, it builds consistency in the review. So for all of those reasons, I think that we've, for a large part, we're getting past that judicial acceptance argument.
So finally, just a few closing thoughts, Eric, on where you think this all is going to go from here. Where do you think that lawyers are going to have to land when it comes to understanding metrics such as precision and recall and effectiveness measures such as confidence intervals and confidence margins and things like that? What do you think with regards to this in e-discovery?
Well, first and foremost, I know I said this earlier in the conversation, but it's really important to understand that while understanding all of these metrics is important, that you know, each individual lawyer does not have to be an expert in this. You know, the key here is to be knowledgeable and have an understanding, but you can leverage the individuals who are expert in this to run these metrics for you, to manage that process. It's important for each attorney that's managing one of these reviews to understand what they are, but again, they don't have to be that expert. And the experts are the ones that are going to be looked at to, you know, for the nitty-gritty details. You know, they may be internal, they could be external, it doesn't matter, as long as you have a confidence in relying upon them. And then don't be afraid to leverage those individuals. Second, validation and reporting are the keys to understanding and success. I don't care how good the technology is, validation is the critical piece in ensuring that the work that's being done is being done right. So understanding that there's a validation process that goes along with this technology-assisted review is key. And those metrics are critical in that validation process. Now, where do we go from here? You know, there's a lot of things happening. Acceptance and implementation is growing. 2013 is the year that technology-assisted review really becomes mainstream. Beyond that is the application of this technology far beyond what we consider traditional litigation. One of the biggest conversations today is big data. How do we manage big data? Things like legal repositories. You know, how can this technology be applied in those situations? And I think we're going to see those types of things starting to happen.
All really good points, Eric. Thank you so much for sharing your expertise with our listeners. But before I let you go, we have something fun in mind for the ESI report, because eDiscovery doesn't have to be serious all of the time. If you're up for it, we would like to play a couple rounds of what we're calling arguably relevant, an eDiscovery puzzler game. Are you game for a little bit of fun?
Sure, why not?
eDiscovery already has a longer history than most people might think. And so we have a handful of trivia questions. This is a test your trivia knowledge, an eDiscovery history quiz, so to speak. A couple multiple choice, true, false, fill in the blank. So we'll make it pretty easy on you, but let's get started. Here's your first question.
Okay.
Question one. One of the first cases to cite Rule 34A was Adams versus Dan River Mills, Inc. In what year was this first eDiscovery opinion relating to Rule 34A?
I'm going to take a stab and say 2003.
Long before that, Eric. Long before that. Believe it or not, 1972 was this first case in which the court referred to computer cards, tapes, and printouts from computers that were going to be required to be produced in discovery pursuant to Rule 34A. Believe it or not, 1972.
I'm shocked.
So number two, true or false, by the end of 2013, there will be more judicial opinions in this decade, so 2010 to present, than in any of the previous decades combined. So combining the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, the 2000s, just in the last 3 years, true or false, there will be more opinions than in any of the previous decades combined when it comes to e-discovery.
Well, I think there's no doubt that, as I think through this, that litigation, the prevalence of litigation has been on the increase, and we're seeing more and more matters being brought. So I would say that is a true statement.
You're absolutely right. There were less than 10 cases discussing e-discovery in the 1970s, one of which we just talked about, the Adams case. So 10 cases in the 1970s, approximately 20 e-discovery opinions in the 1980s, more than 40 e-discovery opinions in the 1990s. And listen to this, approximately 180 opinions in the 2000 decades. And from 2010 to 2012 alone, 185 cases discussing e-discovery. So in the first 2 years of the 2010 decade, we've already had more cases than in all of the 10 years in the 2000 decade. It's just phenomenal, the number of e-discovery opinions that are being written every day.
And that's just in published opinions.
That's absolutely right. Number three. Which was the first state to adopt rules governing the discovery of electronically stored information?
Oh, another tough one. So I would imagine I'm thinking it's either Texas or California. California has when it comes to regulation, has always been at the forefront in many different aspects. Texas, although also has been known for rulemaking and pushing the envelope on things, but I'm going to go with California, I think.
You know, it's neither of them. It's neither Texas nor California. It's a pretty fair assumption, though, about those two states. But actually, the answer was Illinois in 1996. Illinois was the first state to adopt rules governing the discovery of electronically stored information.
Okay.
Today, 36 states have e-discovery rules in place. So there you go. Eric, thank you so much for humoring us a little on that short digression after a rather serious interview on math and statistics associated with predictive coding.
No, it's great. I've learned something. So anytime I learn something, it's a good day.
Well, you know what? Thank you for joining us, and I appreciate it. That was Eric Robinson of Kroll OnTrack.
Oh, it's absolutely my pleasure. Anytime.
Finally, thank you to everyone listening, and thanks to Kroll OnTrack for sponsoring another edition of the ESI Report. For more information on all things e-discovery, check out the e-discovery blog at theediscoveryblog.com. And don't forget to follow me on Twitter at Michelle C.S. Lang. Until next time, I'm Michelle Lang, signing off for another edition of the ESI Report.
This was another edition of the ESI Report, sponsored by Kroll OnTrack. Be sure to follow Kroll OnTrack on Facebook and Twitter, or learn more about Kroll OnTrack software and services at www.krolontrack.com. Thanks for listening to the ESI Report, produced by the broadcast professionals at Legal Talk Network. Join Michelle Lang for her next podcast on the latest e-discovery trends. Subscribe to the RSS feed on LegalTalkNetwork.com or in iTunes. The views expressed by the participants of this program are their own and do not represent the views of, nor are they endorsed by, Legal Talk Network, its officers, directors, employees, agents, representatives, shareholders, and subsidiaries. None of the content should be considered legal advice. As always, consult a lawyer.